Okay, well, thanks for coming out here. Let's just review what we did. The first day, I used a simple theory, which you know well, QED, to introduce the basic concepts of locality, effective Lagrangians, the energy expansion, and matching, which are the core topics. This last time we did a much more serious calculation where we constructed an effective Lagrangian. We showed how to do loops in it and how to do matching at loop level. So we're integrating out at loop level. And the point of this one, that block of material, was mainly that effective field theory is a full quantum field theory. You don't just use effective Lagrangians and stop there. It's a full quantum field theory. So let's just review what we did, because I also need to finish up a little bit of the material there. So we started with the linear sigma model, and we created by hand, step by step, from the linear sigma model, the effective field theory. By choosing the right variables, we were able to find the Lagrangian that gives all scattering amplitudes at low energies. It's that one that's listed there with the trace of over an exponential matrix. So it's got an infinite number of terms in it, but it gives all the matrix elements of the theory at low energy. So it's an enormous simplification. We did integrating out at tree level by taking the heavy field that we had there and going one exchange, and that gave us the first correction. It gave us this term right there. And so we're starting off on the correct theory. Then to do loop level, we had to realize that there can be other Lagrangians besides the ones that we started with. We wrote out the most general one in the energy expansion, so there'll be higher order terms, but this is it. And we did the loops. The loops in the effective field theory are enormously simple. It's the bubble diagram, and everyone can calculate the bubble diagram in their sleep. And we renormalized the non-renormalizable theory. It's non-renormalizable because the one loop corrections are in the terms that are not the original one, so it's not like I'm just renormalizing the overall coefficient. I renormalize some new terms. But that's what we expected, because the divergences, UV divergences, are local. There should be some local term there that gives you that structure if you haven't broken the symmetry. And so renormalization in some ways is philosophically trivial. Maybe not so much technically, but philosophically. And we we matched it onto the full calculation, and we got an exact match if we choose our coefficients right. If we didn't want to do that calculation, and this was our theory, we could go out and measure them, but matching or measuring is sort of the last step. And so we have a whole block of material there on an effective field theory from start to finish at one loop. Any questions on that stuff before I go on? Okay, then I did a little bit too quick start of a discussion on the background field method, which I will try to complete today. And the idea here was to set up for doing some of these calculations in more generality than just doing the one process that we did before. So today I'll do the nonlinear sigma model renormalization in a much more satisfying way. But this involves taking the scary operator trace log d squared, where the operator there has dmu dmu in it, where dmu is the electromagnetic field strength with a the covariant derivative. And we expanded that, and there was some algebra, but it's just algebra of integrating by parts to put derivatives on the external field, on the fields. And this ends up looking like the Feynman propagator squared from x to y, f of x, f of y. And you can sort of see how that happens from the endpoints here being x and y. And the and so the only issue is the number. Now, I did it with massless fields. It actually is the same answer for massive ones, but there's more algebra, and I thought I was going to do more algebra. Do more of the algebra, and I didn't want to do all that. But now, what is this guy? So I haven't completed this, really. The d squared from x to y is the square of the Feynman propagator. So you propagate from x to y, you propagate back. It is the bubble diagram. So here's the point. So we normally calculate this in momentum space, but the d squared of x minus y is the Fourier transform of that bubble diagram. And you can get it just from the usual definition of it in terms of Fourier decomposition of the Feynman propagator. And so when I calculate the bubble diagram, I know I get these 1 over epsilons, which are the divergent pieces. And I either get the log q squareds if the particle's massless, or I get derivatives, I get factors of q squared if the particle's massive, so I get the Taylor expansion. And so here you get to see the same things that we did the first day by doing the calculation and staring at it. But here we've sort of constructed it directly. The Fourier transform of 1 over epsilon is just a constant. Your Fourier transform it, you get the delta function, 1 over epsilon. So here, if I put a delta function there in the, for there, I get FF, so I just get the usual piece. That's wave function renormalization. So you can absorb that into a renormalization of the wave function. That's exactly what it is. In QED, that's also charge renormalization by Ward identities. If I had Q squared, if I have the massive one, when I look at the Fourier transform of that, it gives me the derivative of a delta function, which we saw also earlier. And so this is the higher order. So now I put the derivative in there. That's the effect of Lagrangian that we had before. And if I have the log there, I get something that's not like a delta function. It's non-local. I showed you that before, that we haven't used it much, but it's a non-local effect if things are massless. So what we've done here by doing this calculation in the background field method is done the integrating out of this other field at loop level, explicitly keeping the photon field present in the calculation, and we've reproduced what we did before. Okay. There's a generalization of this, which I should do now because it's common. What if I, instead of having dmu dmu like I had previously, I add another term? This is in fact the most general thing that you can do. Two derivatives that have a derivative and maybe an extra piece if that happens. And then there could be a constant term. And so these all could be functions of whatever background fields there are in the calculation. The steps are the same to what we did before. And the answer is essentially the same. What you see here, this is the divergent pieces. That was the F mu nu that we had before. So I'm just showing you the divergence here. There's also the finite effects. And the 1/12 there is the 4 times d minus 1 in the formula that I have up there. So the coefficient of FF is 1/12. Oh, and there actually is a 1 over 16 pi squared, sorry, that I have not been showing. And the coefficient of the sigma squared term is 1/2. And I have, since I'm putting this in effective action, I have discarded a total derivative in doing this. Okay, but in some ways, that's a nice formula because now, no matter what the background is, I've got the formula. You always have two derivatives. You sometimes have a linear term. So you can then write it in this form. We'll see it in the nonlinear sigma model. So I've basically done a very almost completely general renormalization. In fact, it is completely general of almost any theory that you would ever think of once and for all by using this method. You just put it in this form and you're done. Okay, so you can do all the divergences. I had hoped to do much more in these lectures than I'm actually accomplishing. Last night was actually a sad night because I was throwing out this and I was throwing out that. And one of the things I threw out is the presentation of the heat kernel method, which gets you this formula in a completely different way. You can read it in the dynamics of the standard model, but I'm not going to present it. I'm sorry. Okay. Any questions there? Okay. So now what I'd like to do is I'd like to take the nonlinear sigma model that we had before and do a background field renormalization of that, which is actually, it's a very beautiful object. So here's the logic. It's a little different than what we did before, because before we had two separate fields, phi and a, and I integrated out phi. Here, and in many cases, there's only one field involved, and you're integrating that field out. So the logic is you break the field up, into a background and a fluctuation. That should be fluctuation, but I don't have room to finish writing it. So in general, it's some field phi is phi bar plus delta phi. Phi bar is this background field. You can put the action standard form which is you get L of phi bar plus delta phi, so to quadratic order, delta phi d mu d mu plus sigma delta phi. The linear term vanishes by the equations of motion. So there is no linear term. Equations of motion are the first variation. You then integrate over delta phi. Which is basically amounts to doing the various diagrams that we saw last time, which is, I should just make that, let's change that. There's a little x there for an interaction, x, like that. So you're doing tadpole and bubble diagrams. And then you can pull out the divergences. Which I just showed you with 1 over epsilon, the 1/12 mu, d nu, etc. It's what's written above. Given that you have some local term now with divergences in it, that matches some local Lagrangian. And you put it in the local, write it as a local Lagrangian where you renormalize the parameters. And then, so I've now renormalized, I then apply it at tree level. You don't do loops again. And so basically, here's the pictures that you carry around on this. When I'm doing the regular calculations, I would do something like this. I've now sort of split this up into these external legs belong in the phi bars. The things I'm integrating over are the delta phis. Okay, so you see this split, the things you integrate over are the fluctuations. The other stuff is the external fields. And so then after you've done that integral, you get some local interaction. You don't do more integrals over those fields. You just take these guys coming from the phi bars, the background fields. Okay, I'm doing it here. I'm only doing the divergences at the moment, but you can see from what we did up above here that, see from that calculation, that you can get the finite effects too. You can get the logs, you can get power corrections. You really can get everything by this method. But the, for us right now, the interesting thing is the divergences being renormalized in a non-renormalizable theory. Okay. So that's the general logic. Now for the nonlinear sigma model, the effective field theory that we developed last time, how would we proceed here? Well, we have the field U, which is e to the I tau dot pi over V. That's the field that contains all these pion fields in it. We would write this as U bar, which is the background field, and then I need the fluctuating field. And there are many, in fact, it's by Hogg's theorem, it's actually independent of these choices that I'm about to make. But I'm going to write it using e to the I tau dot delta. Okay, so this is the delta phi, and the phi bar sits in U. Okay. If you see other presentations, they may choose a different set. So then trace d mu u, d mu u dagger is trace, get rid of that. Is the barred quantities at lowest order. Okay, I don't need to write the first term, it vanishes by the equations of motion. The next term, I'll just write it so you see it. It's trace of, the most obvious thing is d mu tau dot delta, d mu tau dot delta, okay. And then the next piece is u bar dagger d mu u bar times, that's tau dot delta. So it's second order, d mu tau dot delta. Ah, let's scribble that away and write it down below so we can see it. Plus, it's u bar times the factors. It's tau dot delta, d mu tau dot delta, plus the reverse ordering. These things don't commute, so it's, I can't. Okay, anyhow. The details aren't crucial for you, but what you can see here is there's the two derivative piece, and then there's a one derivative piece. And so then it's, you can put it in the, our classic form by taking the two derivative piece, and that's the first term in the d mu. The one derivative piece gives me my gamma, and then I have to just rearrange things so that I get sigma. So this carries a few indices because, so this is then, we can write this as trace, well, the trace of this guy is equal to delta A d mu plus sigma AB, it's a matrix now, delta B. And in this form, gamma mu is, I'll write it so that you can see it, trace tau A comma tau B, u bar d mu u bar. And that's sort of obvious. That's this piece here, the derivatives and on one derivative on delta and the other on the u's. And then if you collect terms in the right way, you get sigma is it's 1/8 trace. So it's the commutator of tau A u bar d mu u bar times the same thing with tau B. So commutators. So anyhow, it's algebra, but it is worth seeing what they look like. They're just functions of the background field. And then I do, you work out the 1 over epsilon, 1 over 16 pi squared epsilon times the 1/12 d plus 1/2 sigma, and you get your answer, which we know there's only two terms can be there because we wrote out the most general term, and it turns into the following. It's minus 1 over 192 pi squared, 1 over epsilon, times 1/2 trace d mu u bar, d mu u bar dagger, quantity squared, and then trace d mu u bar, d nu u bar, times trace d mu u bar, d nu u bar dagger. and brackets. Okay, so I get some terms that look like just like my usual thing. This is the same renormalization as we had before. Okay, but we have done something that's actually much more impressive here. We've renormalized all possible interactions all at once. So remember, the basic Lagrangian contains a Taylor expansion in powers of the field that gives me a lot of processes. I don't really want to go through them one by one and do the renormalization in each case. Instead, I've now done the renormalization for all possible processes at once by doing this background field method. And so I put an exclamation point there just to show you that this is not trivial. Yeah. Yes.
So maybe could you give some intuition as to why this background field method works exactly as the Feynman? I don't see the logic.
Okay. So the logic is that we're doing the same loop integrals, mm-hmm. but we're doing it for all processes at once. Basically, when you're doing the old Feynman diagram way where you do it process by process, you take a vertex and you calculate the legs coming out of that vertex. You take another vertex and you have some legs coming out, and then you do a loop in between. Here, what we're basically doing is you're taking those vertices before you've expanded them into the whatever matrix elements that you want. You do the loop, and then you expand afterwards. And so by doing that, you get not only the simplest of matrix elements, but you also get the ones that are more complicated, because they are just an expansion of the external vertices there. Does that make sense? So let me draw pictures, maybe it makes sense. So previously I wrote out my Feynman rules by this is something. This is, you know, p squared over v squared or something like that for this process. And if I had some other process, let's do it the other way. Four guys going in and two guys coming out. This will be p squared over v to the sixth is what it is, because there's six fields there. When I put the first one together as a Feynman rule, I'd do this, where this vertex has come from that expansion and this vertex has come from that expansion. If I were trying to do four particles to two particles, or two particles to four particle scattering, for example, I would start here with two, this vertex up here. I'd do a loop, and then I'd have four particles coming out here, which is the expansion of the same Lagrangian, but on that side, okay? And if I'd go away, I'd have a calculation to do, I'd find my parameters, I'd renormalize, et cetera. And what we've done here is we've taken the whole vertex with all possible expansions there as just by itself, and then we've put out two fields on that side, and so we've done that, this, and then I've basically done this, found the divergences of that, and then this goes into some effective Lagrangian. Let's put a big X there. actually. Let's not put any legs on it. To the big X. No, X is not the right symbol. Let's make it a box. So there's the box there. And then we take that, and when I want any matrix element, I just expand it to tree level. So I would take this box guy and do two legs on this side and four legs on that side, and I'm done. Okay. So in one case, I'm doing the expansions beforehand, calculating each process individually and renormalizing. Here I renormalize an effective Lagrangian on each side and then expand afterwards. Okay. So did you see that? The reason it works, in some sense, I have to say when I first started in effective field theories doing these things, we were doing them by the old method, of course. And it was always it was fun to see that with different processes, you get the same answer all the time. But it wasn't completely obvious. This way, it's completely obvious that if your regularization method doesn't destroy the symmetry, that you have to get a local piece, it has to be expressible in terms of the usual local pieces, and then you're golden, and every process gets renormalized the same way. Okay, so it's a beautiful little technique. Okay, any other questions about that? So I'm going to use this with gravity tomorrow because it's even more beautiful in gravity. But we'll just do it since we've now seen it. Okay. So I have a block now planned, which is just a little bit of the QCD story, and then I have a block on the operator product expansion. So any question before then, let's take it. Yes. Yes.
So in this whole picture, we start with, say, n fields, and we also end up with n fields. And right. So what we've just integrated out some fluctuations around one of the fields.
Right.
Right. So the number of fields we started with is the same in the final effective Lagrangian.
So we've at this vertex here really contains an infinite number of fields. I could, instead of, so these sides here at this stage are the delta phis. Mm-hmm. Here's the delta phis anyhow, delta phi there. And if I had expanded this other side there, I could end up with two fields coming out, four fields, six fields, any number of fields there, because there's an infinite number of vertices contained in that Lagrangian. But I've taken two of them and put them into the loop, and the rest I'll expand later. And so the picture that you see there really has infinite number of vertices on each side. And so I'm calculating all those at the same time.
It means I was thinking in the Lagrangian that we started with.
Right.
In that, if we have, say, three fields are pi's, sigmas, right. And means we have some number of fields before the whole method. Right. And at the end, we also have pi bar, and we have just integrated over, say, delta pi.
Right.
So the number of fields in the number of field parameters in the Lagrangian before and after remain the same. That was my question.
Yes, I mean, I guess the external fields remain the same.
Same, okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's do QCD somewhat quickly. I'm not going to, again, this is some of the beautiful material that I dropped, but I just, I'll just do it as a story. This is the hydrogen atom of effective field theories. Which, by which I mean, it's the one where you can see everything in action and just do it the most simply. Here we have the construction of the effective Lagrangian. The theory has been worked out to tree level, one loop level, and two loop level at this stage. We have physical observables that you can just go out and you can measure them, do comparison with experiment, and these days you can do comparison with lattice. So basically, it's everything you'd ever want to see in action. And so if you need to get a feel for how things work, this is a great place. Okay, I need to do a little bit, which hopefully isn't too far off of what you know. So the QCD Lagrangian has the gluon field strength squared, which doesn't play much role in the discussion here. There's covariant derivatives acting on fermion fields, and there's mass terms. Okay, so for this part of the story, I'm just going to look at the U and up and down quark fields, because these are the lightest. And to do that, I'm going to put psi is psi up and psi down. So it's a two-component vector. And I'm going to add chirality. And this is the part that I hope is not too far afield for you. But if you've seen the standard model, you've seen this. You break the field into left-handed components with gamma 5 here. That's a gamma 5 psi, and right-handed components. So those are projection operators, psi equals psi L plus psi right. Okay. And the Dirac algebra that comes up here is that psi bar id slash psi is the sum of lefts and rights, psi bar left, id slash psi left, plus psi bar right, id slash psi right. If you take the mass term, psi bar m psi, I've written the M inside there because, in fact, now that I've got a two-component object, it's actually a matrix, but is psi bar left M psi right plus psi bar right M psi left. Okay. What you see there is that the kinetic energy piece treats lefts and rights separately, the mass piece connects them. So if M was equal to zero, there'd be separate left and right fields, and they just live totally separately. You would have a global symmetry psi left goes to some 2x2 unitary 2x2 matrix, psi left, psi right goes to some, this should be goes to some unitary matrix times psi right, and that would form an invariance of the Lagrangian. If M is not equal to zero, it's broken. But if M is small, it's only slightly broken. Okay, but there are then experimental facts that we put on that. We see it out of this. So this is meant to be QCD. We see we don't see the left-right symmetry. So the left-right symmetry is not there in the spectrum. Okay, and you know that because there's, if you take let's say a proton, there should be a partner of the proton, which is just a left or right translation of that, which would end up being a proton with the opposite chirality or the opposite parity. And you also see very light pions compared to everything else in the theory. And you put these together and you say that in QCD, if M were equal to zero, the pions would be Goldstone bosons. M not equal to zero, but small pions are almost. So this then motivates you to write out an effective field theory for pions. Which is in fact very close to the theory that I did there. The story continues in, it's basically an elaboration of what we did before. You now have to do some symmetry breaking. Because those masses aren't exactly zero. And we will want to include not only the Goldstone bosons, but the photons and interactions with W, weak gauge bosons, et cetera, just because that increases our phenomenology. So the result goes by reference to Gasser and Leutfeder, who had a beautiful paper describing this early on. Let's snip this, bring it over. This is a little bit more general than we did before, but I can decode it for you. The first two terms are what we did before. The third term is something that if I extend this to up, down, and strange quarks, so this only happens in SU3 instead of SU2. U, D, and S. And so that, for us, for what we're doing, just pions, that one actually is redundant. It can be written in terms of the other two. The pieces that here involve this chi, it's a funny notation, which I also had hoped to explain to you, but because it's actually also beautiful. There's a technique that can be used to take broken global symmetries and turn them into exact gauge symmetries. It sounds wonderful, which is true. I don't have time to present it, but when you're all said and done, this is the notational trick, and it basically that should become the mass matrix is the up and down quark mass matrix, which is a 2x2 matrix times some constant, which is traditionally called B0. And then if I was doing W's, that would become the W fields. If I'm doing photons, the left and rights here is the left, and arm u nu is also the same thing. So in other words, I've got external sources here, which can be photons or W's or anything like that. And I can plug them in. So it's just a slightly more general construction, but it's pretty much the same thing. And now I can do real experiments, comparisons with experiments. So I can do pi-pi scattering. I can do radiative pi decays, W's, E nu, etc. So since I started this by saying that physics is an experimental science, I'd better show you some data. In this case, we don't calculate these in advance, we measure them. So here's the measurements using the measurements of those parameters. So we basically have them measured by something. And then what's left over are predictions. So I'll clip these guys. Let's bring that in. Copy. Just so that it's in the... Let's go back. Yes, that'd be a good time to do it while I'm doing this.
Now we're talking about an effective field theory for pions, right?
Right.
How did we go from a theory where the fundamental particles were quarks,
yes,
to something where the fundamental particle is,
yes,
that's a composite
great,
particle?
That's great. Thank you. It was something that I was planning to talk about in a minute. Let me finish copying, then I'll go straight to that. All right, there we go. What we're seeing here is the degrees of freedom of the high energy theory, the QCD, are different from that of the effective field theory at low energies. It is a new feature for this particular case. And what we've done is that we've shown that the theory has that symmetry, the same symmetry as we had for the nonlinear sigma model, this left and right symmetries. It has the same low energy fields, which are the pions, because we've sort of experimentally seen that. And so if we have the symmetry and the pion fields, that by itself defines the effect of Lagrangian. The theories are, the nonlinear sigma model has the same symmetry as QCD and has the same degrees of freedom. That's sufficient to define the low energy Lagrangian. What will be different of the theories is those coefficients, the coefficient V, L1, L2, all these other guys, are specific to the high energy theory. They come from the high energy theory and are predicted, but it's a small number of coefficients that need to be predicted. So we'll see this in gravity too. When we do gravity, we'll know the low energy degrees of freedom and we'll know the symmetry. We won't know the high energy theory, and it might be something completely different. But just knowing the degrees of freedom and the symmetry are sufficient to write down the low energy Lagrangian. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
I have no trust in this.
Yeah, don't knock your coffee over.
So you don't need to actually have measured the pions, right? Once you know that the quark content is that, and you know that the theory becomes strongly coupled, you're done. You don't need to.
So the theory could have been realized in a different way. So by knowing that the pions are very light, you know that you've done the symmetry breaking, and they're almost the Goldstone bosons. Another possibility would have been that there are no light pions and there are parity doublets, the nucleon and its parity partner. Then you could make that symmetry exist by having left combinations of the nucleon and its parity partner being the left-handed fields and one plus and one minus of those partners. You could have the spectrum show that symmetry explicitly. And then you don't necessarily need to have light pions. But the choice then is whether you have this dynamical symmetry breaking or not. And by finding light pions, you know that you've gone through dynamical symmetry breaking. Okay, does that make sense? No, not really. Okay, so what are the alternatives? Okay, so I have this double symmetry in QCD, left and right. If I did left equals right, it's just like a isospin symmetry. I would just rotate neutrons into protons and protons into neutrons because it's an SU2 symmetry and there's an SU2 doublet there for neutrons and protons. But I have an extra symmetry, and so that isospin symmetry isn't enough. If that symmetry was to be there in the particle spectrum, I'd need to have other particles at the same masses as the neutron and proton in order to have a separate left and right symmetries. Okay, so that could be a case, but we don't see that. So we don't see separate left and right symmetry. So then we suspect that the symmetry is hidden. It's dynamical symmetry breaking, which would normally, if the masses were zero, require light pions, or would require massless pions. Where'd we go? There we go. And we see very light pions, and so we've assumed that they're almost Goldstone bosons.
You mean that you require an extra ingredient? The statement that the chiral symmetry was dynamically broken.
Right, so
after you have that ingredient, though, you don't need to observe the pions. After you have that ingredient,
so
if, the theory is fixed.
If you were able to prove that it was dynamically symmetry breaking occurred, then you wouldn't have needed to go out and make this comment about pions.
Right.
But it would be a consequence of the symmetry breaking. Okay, yes. All right, we're more or less on schedule. So there, I'm showing you numbers, okay? Good, physics is an experimental science. There are the numbers. How well does that work? Well, it's an effective field theory. It's an expansion in the energy. E over some mass to, let's call it lambda, to the nth power. And this, whatever it is, this works like at that approximation. So things that are somewhat higher energies are somewhat worse. Things that are very low energies are somewhat better. The E can never get below the mass of the pion, so there's some intrinsic uncertainty. And the expansion parameter here is roughly 1 GeV. If you get beyond 1 GeV, you can't use the effective field theory, and you basically have to go over to the quarks and gluons to get your dynamics. Okay, there's actually a little window where you can't yet see the quarks and gluons, but the effective field theory fails. And we don't have a good theory for that region. If we did, we'd actually have more tools on our hands.
Done?
Yes.
So by the discussion that was happening, can we start with the QCD Lagrangian and then do a background field method kind of calculation and arrive at the nonlinear sigma model?
So there's not a rigorous way to do it by hand. Okay, and that's a bit of a pain. There are model-dependent ways to do it, but they're just sort of hand-waving. You can imagine taking the QCD Lagrangian and putting a pion field there and then doing a one loop on the fermions and you get something. It doesn't match the real answer correctly. It's not as terrible as you'd think, but it's not right. So that you can do it in model-dependent ways, but QCD is just too tough to solve exactly, and so you can't do it by hand like we could with the sigma model. That was why the sigma model is so beautiful, so much fun. You can just do it. Here you have to use this, your intuition that you've built up through other processes.
Mm-hmm. But is it more... in principle, should that happen? If QCD, we were able to solve things very well, and because you're saying the effective Lagrangian we get just by looking at the symmetries and the degrees of freedom, they match.
Right.
So we say that's our effective Lagrangian.
Right.
But in principle, could we start from QCD Lagrangian and...
In principle, you can, of course. In practice is the question.
Yeah.
So in practice, here's what happens these days. In practice, to solve QCD at low energies, there are you have to use lattice calculations, mm-hmm. computational methods, numerical methods. And what you can do is you can write the effective field theory and define sets of correlation functions, which are basically the matrix elements of the effective Lagrangian. You can do the same correlation functions with QCD. And you can then pull out these various parameters that I measured here. You can pull them out of numerical calculations at this stage. So this is a little subfield doing just this. That's in a sense like what you're doing is you're constructing the chiral Lagrangian because you're defining the coefficients of various correlation functions. If you could do enough of them, you would get all that infinite number of terms in that we got in the effect of Lagrangian. At this stage, it's mainly to calculate those coefficients. And to the approximations that you would expect it to work, there's no known failure. Okay? Anybody else? I'm going to move on from QCD at this stage. Okay, my last topic that I wanted to cover is the operator product expansion. Which is part of the lore of effective field theory. And if you'd seen somebody else give this talk, this would have been probably where they started. Here the interaction are described by local operators. So if you have a theory you're trying to describe, you describe it using local operators. And coefficients. So let's put eyes on that. Let's say I'm looking at the effects of high energy physics. Either of the internal, the high energy components of loops or massive particles or whatever. And so this is what we've already said in effective field theory. You can write that as effective local operators. But the feature that's done often new here is that you often measure it, you match at some energies. And you apply it so the energy scale that you do the matching at isn't necessarily the energy scale you're applying it at. We've been ignoring this feature. It doesn't play much of a role in things that I've described, but though if you go back here, if you look at the fine print up there for the coefficients, I give you a scale that those coefficients are defined at. And what's happening here is that these coefficients become coefficients of a scale mu, where that you take them from the theory where you matched them and you run them to the theory where you're applying them. And the matrix elements, the operator matrix elements, are applied at the scale mu. And so the picture that we have here is generally shown by pictures that look like this. You draw this. And this is not a Feynman diagram. This is the matching scale. You apply it at this scale, and then you draw an arrow there and you say you run in between. Okay, so I just wanna, this little unit is to discuss that process a bit. You might actually, you often see a series of effective field theories where you match, you run, you change your theory a bit and you match again, you run again. You can keep doing this, obviously, if I'm just drawing pictures, but let's stop it here, so you apply it there. And what does that picture mean? Well, let's imagine you're doing something at the, what we're gonna do is we're gonna match at the weak scale, the weak interaction, and then we're gonna try to apply it at low energies, and along the way, there are various thresholds, like the at some stage, the bottom, for very high energy scales in this running, the bottom cork is light, and then you get past the bottom cork and it's now suddenly heavy. So if this scale here might be the W scale, this might be the mass of the B quark, and this might be lambda QCD. So you'd have to do a rematching. All right, let's go back. You have to do a rematching as you go past the B scale because your theories are different below and above it. Okay, so you see this picture sometimes. So the example that I'd like to just talk through is we explain it's in the dynamics of the standard model, which everyone has now downloaded. is of the weak interactions in QCD. So this is a place where it's actually quite relevant. You know your weak interactions at the weak scale. It's as you change your scale, the QCD interactions become important. And then I'm applying it in the decay of the neutron, for example. Okay, so where do we start? We want an interactions that involve quarks because I want to do QCD. The corresponding case is not so interesting for pure electrons and muons. So let's take a process where S goes to an up quark and an up quark goes to a down quark through the exchange of a gauge boson, so a charge gauge boson. So when we do this at the weak scale, we write this as d bar gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5. If you don't know the gamma matrices, it's not that crucial. U bar gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5 s. So there's an operator current that takes the s to the up quark. Something takes the up quark to a down quark. That's a bar. It times 1 over k squared minus m squared. Okay. And I'll drop coupling constants and CKM factors, since that's not that important. So if I did no running, I would just take this and drop that k squared just because I'm going to low energies. I take the interaction being d bar s, d bar u bar s, where I stick these guys in there. Okay, I can maybe write those later, times 1 over minus mw squared. So that's what we've been sort of doing now. We just take the expansion of that propagator to keep the leading order piece. And for notational convenience, I'm going to call this O1. So we're going to have a couple operators. That's O1. So it's minus 1 over mw squared O1 with no running. Okay, the lowest order. If we now try doing this, looking at QCD correction to this, I'm at one loop. Well, we would take the same vertices. Here's a W. This is S U U D. And I dress this in all possible ways using gluons. So basically, I do all the gluonic corrections here. So here's a gluon. And there are various permutations. Okay. What do I get when I do that? Well, we get, instead of just the usual propagator, we get a loop integral. You get the usual propagator loop squared minus MW squared. And if I'm, let's for the moment just neglect the external lines, I get a 1 over k squared from the gluon propagator. And each of the fermion propagators give us a 1 over k, so I get 1 over k squared from that also. So fermion propagators go like 1 over the momentum. So this is what the calculation would involve. And then on the other side here, the operator that would come out of this is not exactly the same. It'd be d bar gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5. And now there's a color factor here. So remember, these guys carry color. Lambda A, which is the SU3 matrix for color. U bar gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5, lambda A, S. So it's a different operator because the colors get mixed up in a different way. And so this is O2. So I've got two of my operators here. And if I try evaluating this guy, I get, again, minus 1 over 16 pi squared, 1 over MW squared, log of the loop momentum magnitude over plus MW squared, evaluated at L is equal to MW, and L equals mu. So basically, this is the magnitude of the loop momentum. This turns into a log mu squared over MW squared. Okay, so at this stage, I've done a little bit of running. I've done this. So the result here is that the weak Hamiltonian is, well, some prefactors, g weak times CKM factors. G weak is basically 1 over the MW squared that I've been carrying along. It's 1 times O1 minus G squared over 16 pi squared log MW squared over mu squared times O2. Okay. So we've gotten our general structure of our operator product expansion. We have two operators that we're playing with, and we've got the coefficients that depend on mu at this way. And then now I won't do that for you because I've ended perfectly on time for once. The next step in this is we know that this logarithm here is a big one because log MW squared over 1 GeV squared is a big quantity. And so at this stage, we do a renormalization group. Summation of, and which basically amounts to iterating. So I'm running down this way. I do infinitesimal steps along the way down and sum them all up. It then ends up being a coefficient C1 of mu O1 plus C2 of mu O2, where the one loop approximations are what I wrote up there, but this has summed the large logarithms in a different way. So this is the renormalization group way of presenting it. And so this is very Wilsonian because it is Wilson. If you know the renormalization group as done in condensed matter, you often do this pattern where you change your scales, your operators mix under the scales. We've done that here now in QCD. The thought process is exactly what Wilson taught us to do. And this becomes then part of effective field theories also. So instead of just, like I had done at the start, just saying that you evaluate the weak interactions by just taking 1 over MW, here this is a more exact way of doing it. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here. That's what I did. This time I planned an appropriate amount. And next time I'm going to spend the whole of the time in gravity. So gravity is tomorrow. Okay, thank you.
Maybe a naive question, but here, why are we equating our diagrams to the Hamiltonian?
It's the interaction Hamiltonian, so it just happens to be, you tend to do the weak Hamiltonian instead of the weak Lagrangian.
But usually when we are doing this, we are writing expressions for Feynman diagrams that are either for amplitudes or matrix elements.
Here we're actually doing it as with the operators, the effective field theory, that's right. So instead of doing the amplitudes themselves, we're doing the operators. You then apply the operators. It's sort of like the we did with the background field method. We did something, and then you applied it at tree level. Here you run it down as an operator expression, and then apply it at a lower energy.
I see.
Okay, so you're right. You can do this. You could have done it with every matrix element that you ever wanted to take of this, or you can do it once and for all, and you're finished.
Yeah, got it.
Okay, so it's a much more beautiful way to do it. Okay, so I should actually say though that, so let's, when we're doing question and answers next, if you're wanting to join for that, I'm going to have to run out soon after my lecture tomorrow. And so, which I didn't realize we would have to cut it that short, but she scheduled me for transport to the airport earlier than I thought. So I won't have much time for gravity questions tomorrow. So I'm going to encourage you to ask them during the lecture. But if you want to discuss anything in particular about the gravity side, don't wait till tomorrow. Come to the question and answer and talk about it then.